Hi, folks. I want to start by saying thanks to Al Mayer and Tom Williams for being regular listeners of The Creationists from the very beginning. Tom and Al created Attic Records in 1974, which went on to become Canada's largest independent record label. I hope that you, too, will be a regular listener to the pod by following or subscribing on your favorite podcast platform to automatically download new episodes as they go live, like this one. Welcome to The Creationists, a podcast about people who create. I'm your host, Steve Waxman. In the late 1980s and early 90s, Kurt Swinghammer's artwork became synonymous with the city of Toronto, as well as the Canadian hip-hop scene. Art critics dubbed it neo-primitive, and his abstract work could be found on radio station logos, business signs, and in music videos. His bold, improvised artwork eventually became ubiquitous and a go-to style in the advertising world.
I was answering the phone a lot and getting gigs, and very happy to do that type of work, that a commercial application for these neat projects. And then ended up doing commercials for whatever, like cereal, like Post Honeycomb and stuff. They had one cereal came out with MC Hammer refraction cards, and the music was hip hop. And they said, let's get that guy that from the Maestro Fresh Rest video. But the joy was, you go into a psych stage and it's 20 feet tall and it's 30 feet wide, and that's a big canvas. Yeah. And I would get like a 14 inch roller and not a paintbrush. And the opportunity to scale up to 20 foot by 30 foot was so exciting, you know. And I got paid, which was like novel.
Kurt Swinghammer has had an extraordinary creative career that has encompassed both the visual arts and music. The artwork he first gained recognition for took visual clues from folk art from around the world and Saturday morning cartoons of the 60s. Over the past decade, he's developed a more mannered graphic style of painting that began with his Red Canoe series. Kurt was kind enough to invite me to interview him in his downtown Toronto studio, which is where we sat, surrounded by paint-splattered easels and original works of art, paintings of icebergs, canoes floating by forests, a psychedelic portrait of Scotty, the mascot from Canadian Tire, a painting from his Red Canoe series, and his latest work of wood carvings that hang on the wall.
Where does the inspiration for your artwork come from, and how does it start?
Yeah, I generally start through drawing, sketching, and that's the one constant, no matter what it's for. If it's a painting, a fine art type of thing, or if it's a commercial project, because I do illustrations, for different things and animation, different things. But I search through drawing, and so that connects me to how I first started when I was a little kid, with crayons and pencils. So it's been this something that is very grounding, and it's not using any heavy technology, so I feel very connected to it. And I explore thumbnail sketches and just try to do as many as possible to find a composition or to find a subject. And that's been the way for me.
So, but what is inspiring the sketches?
Well, that depends on what I'm searching for, and sometimes it can be nothing, like just like improvising in music, you can be just starting and going and see where you go. But at this point in my life, I usually know what I'm shooting for, and that idea might be something that I've just been thinking a lot about. And so it's more of it can be a very cerebral process of having a conceptual thing that you want to visualize. And I sort of need to have layers of ideas that resonate with me, as opposed to just a pretty picture, But it's, okay, so I've got an idea. What image will support that idea, to express that idea? But not necessarily, the idea doesn't have to dominate so that it's completely obvious to the viewer. Maybe the viewer doesn't know, or they can decide for themselves what the image evokes, you know. But for me, I need to have, it's got to resonate for me, and the image has to solve a need that I have to express something.
Well, how long will an idea live in your head before you finally, you know, get to the point of trying to make it a reality?
Well, sometimes a long time. Other times things come, there's no one path. Over the course of my life, I've found that the process changes and evolves, and maybe work that I did when I was in my teens, say, comes back, you know, decades later. Oh, here's, I'm exploring this thing again. But these days I am pursuing content that I also feel will resonate with a public, because I need to support my family, you know. It's to have a child to support, my partner. I, you know, there's definitely a need to be able to get rid of work. And that's the joke is, like, that's the one course they don't teach at our college. Like, what do you do with paintings that don't sell? Yeah. And it becomes a kind of an issue. And I'm just, it's the saddest thing that every decade, maybe you have to go, okay, I guess it's time to trash this work that you couldn't get rid of, right? Fortunately now, I've kind of found a groove where I'm not accumulating a ton of work that's just sitting around. I've found a type of visual vocabulary that people like to live with. So fortunately, the work's getting out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, so you brought something I never would have thought of. What do you do at that point? I mean, what is trashing artwork? Is it just painting it over white and starting all over again, or is it actually throwing it out?
Right.
That's weird.
Yeah, it's like there's a famous story about Michael Snow, who was one of my heroes, really, in the art world, and music and film and everything. When he was living in Toronto in the 60s, he walked past a famous New York artist studio, and I forget who, like Rothko or some heavyweight, you know, and he found some canvases that had been thrown out, and it's like, they were like not great paintings, but he took them, and apparently it was kind of a scandal because the artist didn't intend for anyone just to recognize, oh, this is like somebody's, you know, in all the museums, and this could be valuable. Mm-hmm. But, you know, recycling is definitely one thing. And with my work now, I can't paint on top of a bumpy canvas that's got evidence of another. But Picasso could, and yeah. He did rework his work, you know. There's so many cases of paintings on top of paintings to salvage the material. Because, you know, these days a canvas can cost you $100. So that's not something you just can throw away easily. But I've definitely had to put, I've edited work from the past, things that I feel, oh, this is not great. I don't want anyone to really to see this at this point. And so I've destroyed work for sure.
So how much, or is there pre-planning when you've got your sketch and you're about to delve into turning your thoughts and your idea into reality? Is there pre-planning that goes along with that, or do you just go?
Well, I think everybody's a little different. I tend to just sketch and then go once I found compositions, but it's not, I don't get obsessed with trying to copy. The sketch is just to establish very basic compositional things going on. And yeah, I mean, the work I'm doing now, there's choices are made all the time while doing it, while executing it, in terms of color and placement of things. But I do, because I don't want to waste a $100 canvas, I do know where I'm going, you know, before I start. Right. But in the past, I have done work which is totally sort of, you know, abstract expressionism idea, where you just go and you improvise. Mm-hmm. And I remember hearing about artists in the far north who were working with whalebone materials from their immediate environment, and you know, these stories of the person would stare at the whalebone for extended periods of time until the image revealed itself, and then they would carve what they saw that being revealed. And I remember going through, being very inspired by that, and so creating a ground on a canvas that was just texture, and then doing that type of, oh, what can I pull out of that, you know? So that's, there's so many different ways to approach work.
Right. So when I look at a painting, I try to figure out where the first brush stroke is and how it all begins. So for you as the artist, I feel really fortunate being here inside your space. When you're standing in front of the white canvas, what is the first move?
Right. Well, again, depending on what you're doing, the work I'm doing now, I do a very, very loose underpainting, sort of like the sketch, but the scale of the canvas. So the basic composition, I might rough in. There's been other work where I did this one image called The Red Canoe for quite a while, and the composition was repeated every time exactly the same, and the color relationships changed. And that was at a point when I was doing so much TV and film music that for my art, I didn't want to think about what I had to do. I just wanted to paint. So it became sort of more like knitting or you know, sort of a craft almost, you know. But it was a pleasure because I didn't have to think, oh, what am I going to paint today? Well, I'm going to paint this thing where there's a template and I trace that out exactly every time, the canoe. And then the color is where I just improvise and respond. And when you put them side by side, these paintings, they look quite different because it's really about the color. But that structure was similar. And there's many, many cases in contemporary art where people repeat an image. And people always think of Warhol, but you know, it's a silkscreen thing, a little different. And Donald Judd was this minimalist sculptor. He just did these boxes, and every gallery's got the same Donald Judd piece. But it goes back to Monet, who would do, you know, 30 paintings of
the church,
or things like, or the lily pond sort of thing. You know?
Yeah. Well, okay. So to that end, I want to talk about this graphic style that you're doing right now.
Okay.
When did it start? When did you start doing it? How did it become the style that you're currently using?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've always had a deep appreciation for graphic art and design and illustration, and I never really thought it was any lesser than fine art. And many examples of even people like, you know, Tom Thompson, who is, you know, I reference a lot in my work. He was also, a graphic artist, did cut the bills, right? Like he was doing window displays at Eaton's or whatever, and calendars and things. I've done a lot of CD covers and album covers and things like that, and logos and stuff. But this current style initiated with a CD cover, actually, for a band called Kitchen Music. Dan Goldman, a beautiful composer, guitarist, singer, songwriter in Montreal, put this album out, and Michael Philip Voivoda mixed it. And Michael's a dear friend. He's worked on a lot of my music and as a producer and a mixer. And so I said, oh, I'll do the cover. You know, I'd love to do it. And it was a total indie project. There's no bread or anything, but I just went and created a really lovely cover with a booklet and everything. And one of the images was this canoe and it related to the lyrical content. And when I did it, it was just a tiny little 8-inch painting. I thought, oh man, there's something there. And so, you know, I think a couple years went by and I kept on looking at this thing and thought, oh, I've got to develop it. And it, over many years, it developed into what became this ongoing series called The Red Canoe. And technically, it kept on evolving, and I found ways to create more depth and the colors receding in this way. And it's a very technical way to approach mixing color as well as perspective, you know, the waves recede because of the size, but more importantly, the color recedes. And that's just a very labor-intensive technique that nobody wants to do. And that's why they don't look like anybody else's paintings, because they're very, very labor-intensive. And I thought it was a very, you know, fresh, modern way to depict a pretty trad subject matter, you know? Mm-hmm. Once I established that vocabulary, I felt, well, you know, if I do another series, a different subject matter, it needs to relate. So it doesn't look like a completely different artist did it, of course. Mm-hmm. So I've been since searching for ways to explore that, and that's become this stuff, which is, I think they make great companions, but it's very similar. But in this case, which brushstroke comes first is actually the ones in the background. And that took me a while to figure it out. It took me about, there's four canvases in the dumpster now, but because it was a real, a different way to paint. It was like I had to rethink everything and go backwards and put the backing vocals down first kind of thing, right?
Okay.
And then build up from that. Because that's the only way you could do it technically. So different subject matter, different techniques, they all require a different approach, you know? And sometimes what you would think would be the last brush stroke would actually be the first. Okay. It sort of depends.
So as you were developing, what kind of mistakes were you making at first?
Well, just, it was a new way of expressing this idea of, you know, forest. Mm-hmm. And to my, you know, what I need to do is something that, to feel like it's worthwhile, is that to do something that hasn't been done before. And I had never seen a forest rendered like that before. Mm-hmm. And people are responding to it. Like, it's got energy, and it's fresh, and it's graphic, and it's, you know, it's, I have no interest in trying to be realistic. That's been done. It's can be done fabulously, but with cameras. And so it's to try to find a personal, modern way to depict this subject matter. But it's, yeah, I'm finding there's tons to explore. And for me, like, the canoe is not just it's symbolic for me. And I'm calling this series the Northern Arc, because it's kind of a survival arc, like a escape from global warming and things, you know. That's what it's about for me. Mm-hmm. And the whole water thing I've been exploring, to me it's like this existential crisis that we're in, and it's because a lot of the water pieces, there's no indication of land anywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's more about that. It's about that kind of crisis. And the arc is like, okay, if we all get on board the arc, maybe we'll can ride it out for 40 days if we're lucky.
Oh my gosh. Well, I mean, it's really interesting because it's so much of it, you know, having done the research that I was doing and going through other artists, and I was like, it looks like there's a great inspiration here from the Group of Seven. Obviously, you have in some of your paintings tipped your hat heavily, mm-hmm, to some of the people in the Group of Seven, but more importantly, the serenity. That they are, you know, they're not simple paintings, but they are serene. Because
right,
it's like, it's just the subject in a place that you know is quiet.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I've never thought of that, but there is a stillness to them, and the brushwork is very mannered and very controlled. And whereas, you know, you think of the Group 7 stuff generally being very kind of macho, testosterone, like really you know, they're out there in the woods and they're, you know, putting antifreeze in their watercolor and stuff and dealing with the elements. And but Casson was the one that of that group, and Harris, that I thought was I just connected with more than some of the other guys, and they had more of a graphic, cleaner thing. And I mean, if everybody was painting really super clean and meticulous like this, I wouldn't be. You know, it's more like I just see so much sloppy painting out there that I think I don't want to contribute to the mass of very gestural. And that work can be really exciting and everything, but it's, I'm kind of astonished at how many trends are happening now, that there's a whole pile of things that look the same right now. And I guess there always is in any, there's always trends. But this stuff I feel it doesn't look like other people's work. So that makes me feel like, yeah, I'm doing the right thing.
Oh, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, I spent a few summers renting a cottage in Muskoka. And there's no greater time when you're up at the cottage than 6:30 in the morning when nobody is there. And that's when I first saw the Red Canoe, which was the first of the paintings, right, that I ever saw. I was like, that's what this feels like. And then every other painting that you have is that same feeling. And then I guess a couple weeks ago or a month or two ago, I don't know if it was at the Hatch Gallery, but I saw the painting with the loon, mm-hmm, floating through the water, so you saw the wake. And like, that is exactly what it looks like at 6:30 in the morning when you know, the ducks and the loons just go floating by. They don't even make a sound.
Right.
And that's, and I believe the wake is even white, which is like it's lack of sound, lack of color.
Right. Just, yeah. Well, they're remarkable birds, and yeah, like we don't have a cottage, but we always tap friends that do, and every summer make a point of getting up there. And yeah. Yeah, and as time goes on, I find I connect with it more and more. It becomes really a very meaningful experience for me. And the sound of the loon is just like the coolest modular synthesizer on the planet, right? It's just so great.
So do you remember when you started to create art?
Well, it's been all my life. When I was very, very little, like, I remember the first thing I remember doing was making this little sculpture out of cardboard of a telephone, and my sister was so impressed she took it to show and tell, and I was like maybe four, I wasn't going to school yet, and it just had a natural inclination, and it's really, my dad always stole a paper from the police station and brought it home, and so I had an infinite supply of paper, and I was very shy and introverted as well, so that doing those type of personal things was a good solution. And the same with playing guitar. I mean, you know, I just wasn't the type of kid who'd go out and meet a bunch of friends and you know, do that. I was very withdrawn, and so found these outlets that way. But when I was, you know, in public school, teachers said, oh, you're, you know, you should be, you're going to go to OCA. And like from when I was very little, like I always had this kind of people sort of recognizing something in my work that was just showed a kind of natural ability or whatever.
Do you remember when you started getting serious about pursuing visual arts as a career?
Well, I was selling work in galleries when I was 15. So And I got the art award at the high school in grade 12, and I did very commercial kind of decorative work of, you know, florals, and, you know, some of it was quirkier, and as time went on, it got more away from that, but I was doing work to pay my way to go to OCA and stuff. I wasn't interested in getting a job, you know. So I could make a couple thousand bucks a year when I was a teenager selling little watercolors and things. Okay. And that was enough to go to OCA at the time.
Wow, okay. So My next question, actually, you've just answered, but I'm just curious. When you sold your first works at 15 or something, what were they of?
Yeah, like little, very simple watercolors and inks, like ink drawings with watercolor on watercolor paper. And they're just like, yeah, like flowers and barns were kind of a big deal. Because like, well, like, I grew up with paintings in our house by an artist that my mother collected. And it was very unusual in the 60s that people, like lower middle class people, would have paintings. Like, you know, they might have the Bob Ross type of like, you know, the kind of factory type paintings that people, you could buy at the mall or whatever. But no other people that I knew had actual art. And my mother is just... was keen, and she really liked this one artist in particular, and she bought a bunch of his paintings, which is, again, that's really unusual to have genuine thing. And this guy was like a drinking buddy of some of the Group of Seven guys. And he would go out and paint, and I don't know if it was A.Y. Jackson, I was too young to know what his story was, but And when my parents died, I've got a few of these paintings that I grew up with. But looking back, I think it gave me the idea that having art is amazing, to live with real art, you know, is a wonderful thing. And also the idea that being an artist is a reality, it's a practical choice, you can do it, you know, people can actually make it. And this was in Newmarket, where that's where I was born. Mm-hmm. And so this guy, you know, I don't know how he survived, but he sold paintings to his neighbors and stuff, and they're good. They're really they're well executed oil paintings, and there were these barns and things like that. So the barn became the subject matter that I thought, oh, I'm going to paint barns because people like to have paintings of barns for some reason. And it's a rural thing. When I was a kid, we took a trip out to the East Coast, and I saw these people on the street, artists selling watercolors of ink drawings with watercolor. And then I went to Montreal when I was 14, 15. And the same thing, you go to Old Montreal, and all these artist characters were on the street selling watercolors. And I thought, oh, that's it. I'm going to do ink and watercolor, you know. And I did that for quite a while and you know, got that technique happening. And that was my ticket for a while there.
I want to talk a little bit about your guitar playing. Mm-hmm. Because you are, in addition to being a unique painter, you're a unique guitarist. I mean, your guitar playing is sought after by people because it doesn't sound like other people. And you've already talked about how you were introverted and sitting there with your guitar and not getting... So how did you develop your guitar style? Who are you listening to and to sort of come up with the sound that is Kurt Swinghammer?
Right. Well, I mean, I feel like I'm fairly diverse, you know. I came about guitar, I begged for a guitar when I was seven, and my parents didn't know anything about music, and I ended up with a lap steel without any, like, indication of, like, oh, this can be used to do interesting things. To me, it was just like, what the... there's no way you can play a Beatles song on a lap steel guitar. It's impossible. And when you're seven, I wasn't able to go, oh, I just have to, you know, detune it to something else. But even then, like, that's a complicated instrument if you're trying to chord and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And I just didn't know how to work with it. So I got my rhythm, I think, together. Okay. And that's, I feel, is one of my strengths as a rhythm player. But I didn't get a Spanish guitar until grade 9. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I was obsessed with Neil Young, Gord Lightfoot, you know, Joni Mitchell. And that type of singer-songwriter thing with acoustic guitar, at that time, that was really what I was trying to emulate. And Joni Mitchell's technique of having a backbeat, like she would smack it, and I picked up on that. And never had lessons with the Spanish guitar, I just taught myself. And I'd buy the books to the albums, you know, For the Roses or whatever, and And Joni's chords are like, I mean, because she's always tuning, right? Like, it's got 40 different tunings or whatever. So that was complicated. But Neil Young's are so easy, like so simple, his chords, and the structure are very simple. And I also got, I was really inspired by Burt Bacharach, and that was also more complicated chord structures and stuff. And I think Joni and Burt Bacharach are probably really inform my sense of color for composing, especially Bacharach. And his use of asymmetry, like using broken time signatures and things. And I use a lot of sevens and fives and nines, even 11s in my writing. And then guitarists, you know, like there's so many that I admire. But I started also when Eno came out with Another Green World, that was to me the most exciting album on the planet. And it just really opened up a world of new, exciting music to me. And it's still one of my favorite albums of all time, Another Green World. And I think the sounds that Eno was getting from his synths and from other players and stuff suggested a sonic approach of creativity that I started looking at my guitar differently. And when I went to OCA, the most important thing I learned was about music there, actually, and because the music gallery was kind of next door to the Ontario College of Art. And for a couple of years, I was only listening to people just like total mad improv and sawing at things and inside the piano. And that was just, to me, seemed way more exciting than punk rock, which just felt like kind of like nursery rhymes played really loud and fast, you know. Like it was, the rock vocabulary had been already long established, and to me it wasn't interesting to play 1-4-5. No matter how fast and how aggressively. But at the music gallery, I mean, that was just music you'd never heard before. So that was so exciting. And that had a big impact on my playing, too.
Well, that's cool. So I moved to New York in 79 to go to college.
Nice.
And mid-80, maybe early 81, is when Keith Haring's Atomic Baby started to show up in the subways and on these street lampposts and on the sides of buildings and stuff. When I moved back to Toronto, a few years later, mid-80s, late-80s, I think is when I became aware of your art through the Shuffle Demons.
Right.
Whether it's Roach Get Out of My House or Spit Out of the Bus, I don't know whichever. And it reminded me immediately of Keith Haring's work, and I didn't know who you were, though I had heard the name around, and I had been working at Ready Records, so the name was your name was in the air, and I knew that you were an artist and a guitar player, but I was curious as to how that. Okay, so people decided to call it neo-primitive art.
Yeah.
But what was the inspiration? How did that style that became really a style that defined Toronto for a number of years?
Yeah,
even before the Maestro Fresh West videos, and then became the look of hip hop music out of Toronto for a while as well. How did that come about?
Well, for me, it was like I always felt that, you know, Rocky and Bullwinkle and the Flintstones, that kind of those cartoons were made as big as an impression on me as any fine art, and I always just loved cartooning. You know, just it was. That's what I did in all throughout high school. When the teacher was talking about math problems on the blackboard, I was drawing cartoons. And in the 80s, I guess it was just, you know, there's certain people. Yeah, like Haring, you know, captured a lot of attention and had a lot of influence. I didn't know of his work until people started saying, oh, hey, your work looks like this guy from New York who's blowing up. And I was like, really? And then I remember looking, I go, shit, he's beat me to the punch. I'm like, he's done it, you know, the stick figure. And I remember actually doing a stick figure once on this kind of mural thing that everybody was throwing stuff up on. And this one guy who was from New York said, oh, I like that. And I thought, oh, that's cool. Like, you know, I can just do a stick figure. And somebody says, but that person was familiar with what Herring was doing. Yeah, and for me, it felt very anti-establishment, anti-corporate to do something just kind of rough and cartoony and, you know, not slick and stylized, but just kind of raw. And I felt that was in resistance to what I felt was very corporate, you know. So, you know, the bands that I got to work with, they were, you know, signed to major labels, and it wasn't money involved. It was just very independent. And so that look lent itself to that. And then, you know, at that time, it was just people were asking me to, like, CKLN, the independent community radio station, asked me to do their stuff. And it just felt like, oh, yeah, this is... this kind of visual vocabulary is just kind of rejecting the clean, you know, precise corporate graphic look that's out there. Mm-hmm. And I thought it had some kind of vitality, you know.
Were you aware at the time of Australian Aboriginal art?
Well, all folk art from all over the world that I'd seen, I felt, now that's the shit, you know, like, that is not going through filters of you know, money, and it's done from the heart. And there's, but in, you know, growing up in Southern Ontario, I never felt I had any heritage that I could go to. Like, my parents didn't have any. They were just trying to blend in to, you know, Southern Ontario. But every folk art that I saw, including, you know, Australian stuff, it was like, oh, that looks amazing. And so I was conscious of trying to embracing that aesthetic, that it's a folky tradition as opposed to a corporate type of thing, you know.
It's interesting. It sounds in this conversation that you have very consciously tried to establish a style that is recognizable and that it then becomes attached to Kurt Swingham, whether it's your guitar playing or your art. I mean, you've had... I have not seen all of the art that you've created in your life, but you have two significant periods in your artwork that from... what we're talking about right now, the primitive-ish artwork from the mid to late 80s and early 90s, and this new style, which, how long have you been doing this now?
Well, it's evolved, but the roots of it do go back 15 years for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Again, I was, I went through a period of 15 or 20 years of really dominated by being in front of a computer doing film music and, you know, TV music. Mm-hmm. And that can be relentless. People that know that world, you know, you pull in long hours for, you know, a month solid, and maybe you might have a couple of days off, then you're entering. It was nonstop. So I wasn't generating much visual work then.
Okay.
And again, that came to, one of the solutions was, well, just find something to paint that I don't have to think about. Because I do find it, going back and forth between music and visual work, it will refresh one another and keep me enthusiastic. It doesn't feel like I'm repeating myself all the time. I would think that for some people it looks like I've abandoned what I was doing and doing something completely different. But I've always had a sort of different styles and never felt uncomfortable about having them happen at the same time. And the second art show I ever saw in my life, the second time I ever went to an art gallery, was Harold Town. And he was in the Painter's 11, and probably in the 50s and 60s, the most celebrated Toronto artist, who's kind of a larger-than-life character, fantastic painter. And he had dozens of different styles. And the show I went to see was in Oshawa, the McLaughlin Gallery there. And he had, there was three rooms, and each room had just incredibly distinct bodies of work. It looked like by three different artists. And so that was the second show I ever saw, and I was like, oh, you can do that. You know, it wasn't, you know, very normal for people to show work like that, but it gave me inspiration. Like, oh, I don't have to follow this path of trying to have a look, you know. Mm-hmm. So that was actually an inspiration to not be hung up on that. Right. But with this body of work, I'm keeping the vocabulary tight because I it can be confusing for the public to see. They assume that an artist has a style, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm very, very mindful of keeping within that, and while trying to evolve it and push forward, not to abandon, you know, where the body of work came from. Mm-hmm. But still, at the same time, I'm doing another pile of stuff right now that doesn't look anything like this.
That was actually exactly the next question is, I presume that there's stuff that you're doing right now that either is just for you or is a part of your evolution.
Yeah, there's a different body. And like those things, that's a, you know, these wood pieces, yeah. They don't look like these paintings, but, you know, different material and everything. But when you do put them side by side, oh, there's a sensibility with the line and stuff, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, I do. Oh, that's the Canadian Tire guy.
Then. Yeah, no, I was going to say, I didn't want to be ignorant, but I figured it was the Canadian Tire guy.
Yeah.
But even that has a large touch to the primitive stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was, I mean, that work.
It's sort of call it primitive.
Oh, no, I know. That was thrown, neo-primitive was thrown around a lot, and yeah. I don't know if maybe it's not politically correct or something anymore. I don't know, but it ran its course, and then I started seeing that look applied to. I remember somebody said, "Oh, I saw a Taco Bell ad, and it looks like you did it. Did you do that?" It's like, no. And then I remember seeing it. Oh, geez, that some, you know, art studio, commercial art studio has lifted that look and, you know, applied it to these commercial clients. So I thought, I got to, you know, kind of move on from that, I think.
Well, I was curious, though, too, about that period of time. I mean, it is such abstract art. And, I mean, in many of our minds, it's the bamboo, it's CKLN, it's Sammy Recordman's, you know, bag, it's the Mice for Fresh West videos, and the Dream Warriors and all this. Were you just doing canvases like that as well at the time?
Well, that's
or similar.
Yeah, but not a ton. But like, I got really, I was answering the phone a lot, mm-hmm. and getting gigs, and very, very happy to do that type of work, that a commercial application for these neat projects. And then ended up doing commercials for whatever, like cereal, like Post Honeycomb and stuff. They had one cereal came out with MC Hammer refraction cards, and the music was hip hop. And they said, "Let's get that guy that from the Maestro Fresh West video." But the joy was, you go into a psych stage, and it's 20 feet tall and it's 30 feet wide, and that's a big canvas.
Yeah.
And I would get like a 14-inch roller and not a paintbrush, mm-hmm. and the opportunity to scale up to 20 by 30 foot was so exciting, mm-hmm. you know. And it, you know, I got paid, which was like novel.
So how did you break into the Toronto market or the graphics market?
Well, this, Shuffle Demons was the first thing. I'm pretty sure that was the first gig. And I lived in a shared residence with a bunch of other musicians. Mm-hmm. And everybody seemed to be playing in each other's bands. And there's a heavy jazz scene at this place where I was. And so the Demons were, you know, I got to know Rich. And he saw what I was doing and just said, hey, you know, do you want to do this? And then I was in Vital Signs, a band with Glenn Milchum was in that band at the time. And I did their cover. And so that got nominated for a Juno Award or something at the time, you know. And so it just sort of like expanded from there. And some things had a lot of, like the CKLN stuff had a lot of presence actually in Toronto. And then from the, you know, CBC called me, oh, can you do, you know, this, the Entertainers, a radio show, you know. So I kind of like, it trickled up.
So, in closing, if you had to give one up, music or painting, what would you give up?
Jeepers. Well, I don't know. I've never really thought of that or considered. Like, they're very complementary for me.
Okay.
And, I mean, the music has the live component, which painting doesn't, you know, like... So I think and often it involves collaborating, which painting generally doesn't. Mm-hmm. So to counterbalance, you know, my inclination to be solitary, music is good for me to collaborate with other musicians, to go perform live. So I think that has more resonance. Plus it's invisible and I think music is maybe more powerful. And I play music when I paint, you know. So I'm always absorbing music.
My question about whether he'd give up art or guitar is, of course, theoretical. Kurt's not likely to ever give up either. As a matter of fact, he was pretty proud of the fact that he had his art supplies on wheels that could easily be moved out of the way to convert his studio into a performance space. If you'd like to check out Kurt Swinghammer's art, I've posted photos of a number of pieces discussed in this episode on the Creationist podcast page on Facebook and Instagram. You can purchase his work through inabstracto.com, or you can visit his website, kurtswinghammer.bigcartel.com. Also, Kurt's music can be heard on all music streaming platforms. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate and leave a nice review. That helps us find new listeners. The Creationist is mastered in post-production by Paul Ferrand. I'm Steve Waxman, and I created this podcast.